You should put salt on your tortilla chips at dinner, not your field when you're irrigating. HSI water uses sulfurous acid to neutralize bicarbonates, lower soil pH, and flush salts from the root zone. Cleaner water, healthier soil, less buildup in your lines. Producers who get their irrigation water dialed in see better nutrient uptake, improved infiltration, and reduced fertilizer costs season after season. Getting your water right is one of the highest return investments on the farm. Our specialists will work with you to design the right system for your needs. No guesswork, just a clear picture of your water chemistry and a plan that fits your operation. So, is your water working for you or against you? Find out at hsiwater.com.
Text SALTY, that's S-A-L-T-Y, to 979-232-2528.
Hello, friends, and welcome back again to Conservation Stories, a podcast brought to you by the Sand Hill Area Research Association. I'm your host, Tillery Timmons-Sims, and this is Dusty Timmons, who, yes, may be related to me.
A little bit.
Just a little bit. He's my baby brother. Not the babiest baby, but my younger brother.
Yeah.
So I asked Dusty to come because he made a big sacrifice for me recently.
I got to go on a free trip.
He had to go on a free trip to a hunting and fishing lodge. So that he could interview all of these amazing people in conservation. Now, I sent him, I was like preoccupied, did not already made previous commitments, and so... Dusty, not only did he do that, though, you went down there fully equipped with equipment you barely knew how to use.
Yes, got it 4 days before I left.
Exactly. So we're kind of flying by the seat of our pants, but we are going to introduce his series and over the next few weeks, and we wanted to do one podcast to kind of introduce what he did and the folks kind of that he'll be talking to in that series. So 11 podcasts you recorded over the weekend.
Is that how many it wound up being?
I think that's what you've told me.
Yes, that's what I told you. That's near as I can remember. I know it was a whole bunch one day and quite a few the next day, and then I think I finished off at midnight Sunday morning. So just after midnight. It started at 11:30 was when I started my last one. So.
Wow.
But it was really, I mean, it was an amazing experience. I mean, meeting the people that were down there and interviewing the people. Did you happen to know that there are great white sharks in the Gulf of Mexico?
No.
Yes, there are great white sharks in the Gulf of Mexico. I interviewed the founder of the Gulf Great White Society and talked about it. There was one that was actually tagged off the coast of, like, Maine or something like that. And then, like... Or maybe that. It was somewhere on the East Coast.
Okay.
It was tagged.
Yeah, it's a long
And then, like, a couple weeks later, it was tagged.
No.
It was binged, I think, just right off of South Padre Island.
No way.
Like, ridiculously close off. I'm not going.
I guess I never thought about it.
Well, we've always been told there's not.
Okay.
I mean, that's the thing. Yeah. It's always been, you know, if somebody said, hey, I saw a great white shark in the Gulf of Mexico, there people are like, no, you didn't. You just thought you did. It was something. It was a big tiger or something like that.
Okay, yeah.
But it's pretty interesting. And, you know, his whole deal is just, hey, he's a well-versed and well-traveled. He does a lot of different things.
Yeah.
Very interesting guy. He's got a really interesting documentary
on the
shark, the great white shark, that you can get off of Netflix and YouTube, I guess, is where it is.
Oh, cool.
Anyway, talk about that in there.
Okay.
I would tell you what the name of it was, except I have slept since then.
Well, what we'll do is we'll help collect all that information and we'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
So, like, after you visited with somebody, you know, all that stuff will be.
But it's really cool.
Yeah.
I mean, that was really interesting. I met with the head of the Wild Sheep Foundation. And we got to talk about desert bighorns in Texas and Mexico and doll sheep and stone sheep and bighorn sheep and how they're growing, how they're doing, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, in that conversation, we talked a lot about invasive species. Texas has, we're back up to 475-ish desert bighorn sheep in Texas. And they're
475?
Yeah.
We were up to almost 2,000. That doesn't seem
and then
like
they
a
had
lot.
A disease blow through the herd and just smacked it down. And it's growing again, you know, but it's, but.
Where are they mostly located?
Big Bend.
Okay.
Well, that area, the Guadalupe Mountains. They're desert, so it's in that desert area out over there, the Chihuahuan Desert.
Chihuahua Desert.
Mm-hmm. And through there, and you know, they range extends through New Mexico and Arizona, you know, and I believe some maybe in Nevada. There's that's where the desert bighorn is, but it's, you know, they're an animal that lives in very limited carrying capacity areas.
Well, that's
true.
And
the biggest problem, one of the biggest problems they've got is Texas has 100,000 oddads in the same area.
Oh, yeah. And I get those, sometimes I get those two confused.
Yeah. Well, oddad come from, you know, the other side of the globe.
And they're, because I was like, they're pretty much not supposed to be here, kind of.
Well, they were introduced back in, I don't know, like the 30s or something like that.
Oh, really?
To increase game hunting opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And have adapted very well. I mean, oddly enough, they get their rates of predation, and I don't want to go too far into the weeds because I cover all this in the deal, but their rates of predation from like mountain lions and bears and stuff like that is actually lower than desert bighorns. Hmm. And so not only they
interesting.
They're, you know, they're tough animals.
Yeah, well, they've been here several generations, so they probably have had time to adapt. So tell us a little bit about Derek York, who is the hero.
He is the hero. Put it all together.
Wow.
Works for the Texas Parks and Wildlife as a day job.
Okay.
He drives a boat for the Texas Parks and Wildlife out in the Gulf doing research and things like that.
It's, now, what a job.
It's a pretty cool job. He's a Tech 3, I believe. And ironically, he is the only one that I really, really, really wanted to interview. He was not in the normal rota of who would interview because he was a podcaster.
Okay, to just get him. We'll have to do it.
Do him. Because what he's done is, I mean, the breadth that he's gone to, the energy he's put into facilitating the growth of conservation organizations, not just conservation, but charitable organizations as well.
This, it's like an exponential, like what he's done for this weekend is unbelievable. Because we now, you know, you were able to interview all these people that we may have never even heard of before.
Yeah, I mean,
I hadn't heard of any of them.
I heard of the Wild Sheep Foundation.
Okay.
Being a hunter, I was familiar with that, you know, but I did not know I did not know Gray Thornhill, Thornton, or his wife either. And his wife is a really cool lady, too. I got to interview both of them separately for two separate things.
Oh, nice.
Because she heads up, well, we'll go into what she heads up later. I could chase rabbits a lot.
That's okay.
But so, but Derek did, he put together a deal where you go in and, I mean, we said, the first morning when you're eating this phenomenal breakfast, he sends everybody a text message. Everybody's got a Excel spreadsheet deal with the times on it and who you're going to interview. And you get you got 9 to 12, and you break for lunch, and you have an incredible meal at lunch. And then you go from 1 to 4. Doing it. So you do 6 of them on Friday. And then so you'll have, and so you don't have to worry about coordinating. Because I asked him about, you know, in the course of just discussing, how did this do this, you know? And I'm like, man, I love this. And he said, with the first couple of times we did this, we kind of just let everybody try to figure it out. And it was just a clown show.
I mean,
it was just, he said, you know, it was, you have some people that were great and really aggressive and just going and just lining everything out. And other people that were just like, didn't want to really, you know, inconvenience anybody. And so he said, I just said, doing it this way. He said, removes the guesswork. And he said, you still can, there's time after that you can get, if you want some more, you can do some more and interview other podcasters and stuff like that. And I did interview one of the ones I did was a podcaster, and she's from Vancouver, British Columbia.
Interesting.
She was Gray Thornton's wife is also originally from Canada, but they live in Montana. She and her husband live in Montana.
Okay.
but she has a podcast up there. I think it's, her podcast is called Women Hunt. It is a really cool, it's in conjunction with the Women Hunt program that Grace, and I'm going to have, that is driving me nuts that I cannot remember her name. So
you go right ahead. Go right ahead and look it up.
Well, I figure what her.
Well, I had.
Renee Thornton. And Renee, if you see this, I apologize, I forgot your name. But just know I'm terrible with names. But Renee saw a need and started a program through the Wild Sheep Foundation to get more women into hunting. And what they put together is amazing. And then in the course of it, she was like, you know, this needs to grow a little bit. And then she kind of ran across Dana and kind of just started following her on social media, and then like followed her and was like, hey, would you be interested in doing a podcast for us? And so she's just started as of when I was coming back, she only had nine episodes up. Okay. So she's just getting started on it, but really cool lady. I mean, both of them are amazing.
That's great.
I mean, Renee is, I mean, what Renee has accomplished is really impressive. But they, I mean, and what she's done with the Wild Sheep Foundation, what they've done, I mean, they basically will, if they have it's basically a competitive program. You have to like write essays and do stuff to get selected to this thing. And they only take like 12 women a year, and they take them to this ranch, a really nice place in the hill country during deer season.
Okay.
And they go down there and they go in one day, and they have ex-military and ex-special forces snipers, stuff like that, teaching them how to shoot.
Holy cow.
And so they spend a day learning how to shoot. And then they, and you know, getting familiarizing themselves with fire, because some of these people have never touched a gun.
Right.
And so they, you know, go over safety, they teach them the basics of it, how to pull, you know, how to make it go bang. And then the next day they dial it in, find their comfortable range, and that afternoon, that evening, they're sitting on a stand. And then they'll take them out, and then, you know, they shoot, they try to shoot at the management deer on the ranch there.
Right.
Shoot that. Anybody that shoots it, then they all cut, they bring it all back in and teach them how to completely field dress it, skin it, you know, cape it, quarter it, break it down into all the way from there into a meal. They literally take these women and they go from, and I've been hunting for 40 years, would take it in a heartbeat. I'd pay the bill to take this class. Because, you know, amazing. And, I mean, I've done all this stuff, but just, you know, because all the stuff that I whatever your grandpa told you may not be the actually easiest way to do things.
Right.
And
right.
they go in, and right. I mean, it's amazing what they do and what they put together, the program they put together.
Wow.
And then I got to, so anyway, you go through and you do the interviews. That's a nice little rabbit trail we chase there.
Yeah.
So you go through and you do the interviews, and then you go out, and from 4 to 6, you've got pretty much got free time. But you can go out and you can shoot 5-stand, which is clay pigeons, mm-hmm. where you sit there and you say pull, and the guy pushes a button, and clay pigeons fly. It's the best way to shoot clay pigeons. I mean, it's like playing golf without actually having to swing. It's great. and so that, you can do that. Or you can go on one of their 5 ponds that they've got there that are stocked with bass and go fishing. And I, bizarrely enough, only made like 30 casts. And on 29 of them, I was dragging the weeds, and I was hung up in the weeds. And on the 30th, when I had caught a fish. So, I mean, it was a lot of fun. We had, one of the podcasters there is from Hemphill, Texas. And he is a fly fishing guide on Toledo Bend. But he also makes handcrafted, bespoke fly rods that are amazing. I mean, incredible. Wow. He like the rod blanks. He helped design all the rod blanks and the other.
Oh wow!
I mean, it's incredible. And the odd thing about it is, for a fly rod, they're inexpensive, and for a custom fly rod, they're downright cheap.
Wow!
I mean, they're still wallet, but they're still high. Yeah. But for what they look like and how beautiful they are, I mean, he'll match it. He said he was at a show one time and had a little Asian lady, and she was like from, I think she was from Japan.
Okay.
And he's like, he's of course, seventy-ish-year-old. Fella, and and as hillbilly, I mean, I'm a hillbilly, and he and I were just like this, man. And he's like, she comes. Oh, your rod's too big. And he's like, what? And he's like, of course, he's got a real thick accent. He's like, I couldn't understand her accent for nothing. You're like, I don't know how that works. She got two really big accents. But anyway.
That's hilarious.
The handles were too big for her. She's a little bitty tiny.
Oh.
So she was like 4 foot something. You know?
Oh, sure.
And so he's okay. Like, well, let me measure your hand. So he said, I measured her hand. And then when I got back to my shop, I on this really nice wood.
Yeah.
He said, I turned 3 different handles for her with these exotic woods. And I sent them to her, and she picked the one that she wanted, sent them back, and I built her a rod around it that perfectly fits her hand. And she said,
that's
neat.
It's
really cool. I mean, that's
something I've always wanted to try is fly fishing.
It's wicked fun.
You know, I have a phobia about fishing, and that is being next to anyone who is like slinging around a hook. I am like so paranoid about getting hooked by one of those hooks.
Yeah.
So I feel like if I was fly fishing, and I have to be like, stay a long ways away from me.
Well, you know what's funny is I actually went out with, I mean, everybody there was, like, I can kind of cast a fly rod. I'm one of the people that I'm out there, and if you don't know what you're looking at, I know what I'm doing. But if you have a clue of what's going on, you're like, that guy.
That's kind
of
how I'm on this podcast. I sound knowledgeable for the first 5 minutes.
But I was not, like, I was like, I want to watch you cast. And he's like, okay, well, just stand right here. And I was literally standing in his left hip pocket. And he was like, okay, you just do it this way.
I guess it is. See, I think my fear comes from fishing as a child with two younger brothers.
Hey, I never remember fishing with you.
Oh, yeah. Down at Lake LBJ.
Oh, I remember Lake LBJ.
Oh, yeah. Well, that is because the first time I got hooked, I never was like, No.
I know I was fishing with a guy one time that got hooked. Not a treble hook. But, well, the good thing about fly fishing is the hooks are typically, well, if you're trout fishing with a fly rod, the hooks are typically really, really small, and they're mostly barbless, so they come out.
Oh, nice.
It makes life easy. Yeah. So it's not any more painful than having your ear pierced.
Right. Yeah. Sure. Okay. So, okay.
Remember that Easter I had my ear pierced?
I do. I remember. That was pretty funny. Yes, I know.
The links I'll go to get a laugh out of it.
I know. Exactly. So it was Friday, Saturday, and then y'all left on Sunday.
Left on Sunday, yeah.
Wow.
And so we did Friday. And then after you get the 2 hours off, they have what's called movie night. Not movie night. What did you call it when you have a film festival?
Film festival.
And they had all the different podcasts that had put together videos. National Wild Sheep Foundation had one they'd put together.
Okay.
The Great White Society. Yes. The Gulf Great White Society had one they put together on the Gulf. That one, there was another one that was put together by another guy that had worked with what is now the CCA, which used to be the Gulf Coast Conservation Association, just the Coastal Conservation Association, something like that. Anyway, he started working with them in the 70s when they were using gill nets on redfish in the Gulf, in the bays, and trying to get that stopped. And now he's working to protect oyster beds.
Oh, yes.
He put together called the Tipping Point, I think is what it's called, on the oyster beds in Texas. And that is a grave situation. I mean,
it is a bad deal to lose them.
It is a horrifically bad deal.
Yes, yes.
You know, and it's another one of those things that's just been kind of a mess.
Yeah, when I was in Tall, we went to a place where they're doing that, and on Long Island, where they're using it, to filter.
Yes.
You know, and so they were like, it was a nursery.
Yeah.
An oyster nursery.
Well, one of the things that they're doing with that they got them to do is the, what are they called? COLs, I think is what they're called. Anyway, you can go out and you can basically rent a part of the bay, and you can make an artificial,
I've heard of this. That's really cool.
There's now 2,000 acres of that, and it supplies 30%.
It's kind of like how we here rent a highway and clean up the beer cans.
Kinda.
Yeah, but there it's like you can rent and you get to like
grow oysters and sell oysters.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you look at the oyster boats out there, I mean, they show and you see the satellite, you see the images that were taken. I don't know if they're aerial photos of some sort. They're either satellite images, like on a Google image, and you see what they're doing to the oyster reefs. And, you know, those things are not something that, it's not like running a combine through a cotton through a wheat field and then going back planting wheat and combine the wheat again. Right. When they do that, they can destroy the substrate that the oyster's attached to.
So
that reef can be gone. And they cut down something like 96 or so percent of soil erosion behind those reefs. Like you compare where an oyster reef is behind it to what's not there. And the erosion
levels
are
That is what's so crazy to me about, as I learned about conservation, is the ripple effects are insane. Yeah.
Then, you know, some things have bigger butterfly effects than others, but to me, this one has one of the biggest ripple effects I've seen in anything that we do.
Wow.
I mean, even with, you know, the destruction of the tall grass prairies and how much that's shrinking in and how much you've got the green glacier, you know, with trees growing in and encroaching in the prairies, and then you got the plows busting it out. I mean, even with that, it's less dramatic than what the oysters do to the bay.
And can people don't know, the tall grass prairies are the most endangered ecosystem in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's ironic.
It's like Oklahoma.
I mean, it's
not far from us.
Right, yeah. And it's, you know, and that's a a combination of things that's endangering it. It's not just farmers plowing it out. I mean, it's people saying, you know, hey, it's Arbor Day. Let's plant 1,000 trees today.
Right.
You know what? Don't plant 1,000 trees in western Kansas.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not what it's designed for. It's not what it's there for. I mean, it's great, you know, in a shelter belt or something like that. But you plant, you got a lot of juniper and
especially things that aren't invasive. I mean, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of funny. You know, Bradford pears are no big deal out here because we don't get enough rain for them to spread like they do. But
people
in the Southeast,
oh my goodness, people hate them so much. And I'm like, they're the only thing that even looks pretty around here in the spring and fall.
It's either that or Chinese.
I know.
Chinese.
I don't know what are those called? Japanese redbud or something? I don't know.
No, I'm thinking about the Chinese elm. That's what I'm thinking of.
Oh, yeah, elm trees.
Oh, my God.
Yes, and those do spread too. But, I don't think people hate elm trees as much as they hate Bradford pears.
Yeah, no.
Because they say they smell bad.
Well, I don't know.
The ones across the street from me, I've never smelled them, but I'm like.
I mean, out here, it's not a big deal because they're an invasive. They're an introduced species out here.
Right.
And so they're not native to here.
Right.
But there are areas in the Southeast where they plant them where they're actually invasive.
Yeah.
And they actually grow and they actually spread.
Right.
Whereas here here you're lucky to keep the one in your yard alive for 20 years.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I mean, which is, I think, one of the reasons why people don't like them is they're like, the branches are weak and they will, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I will tell you, like, sometimes I wonder about, like, who gives advice about things, because I know that I've seen like the most beautiful, enormous live oaks cut down when pears were kept.
Yes.
We're going to keep these pears, but we're going to cut down. And I was like, oh my goodness.
that's
who gave? But I mean, you know, it's people get, they're getting advice from people. And I'm like,
take it down because it might get oak wilt.
Let
it get oak wilt and before you take it down. But I mean, there's, you know, that can go on.
It'll get in your plumbing. I'm like, what do people do where they live where they have trees? They also have plumbing. Somehow they are able to. Anyway, so we're totally off the topic. But anyway.
Just a little bit.
Yes.
But, I mean, you know, we're nothing if not, you know, random.
Exactly. So true.
I mean, then you come back in. I mean, you've got this another freaking, I mean, it was not a hardship because I had another incredible grand meal. And then you go and you get up the next morning and you roll through it and do it all again, and just incredible. I mean, I spoke with a lady, Camille Null is her name, and she's from Port O'Connor, and she works with the Heroes on the Water program, where she takes vets and first responders, get them in kayaks and get them back into fishing.
Yeah.
And she told a story that I won't repeat here. You'll just have to listen, find a podcast when it comes out and listen to it. But, I'm just sitting there. It's like, I'm going to have to pause this thing because I'm not sure anybody can hear me because I'm crying. And it's like, but, I mean, it's really, her husband is a retired Houston homicide detective. And they got out and moved to Port O'Connor, and now he's a fishing guide. And, he was supposed to be there, but he got sick, and so I didn't get to interview him too. But she was incredible, and that, you know, the what she does in getting people that have, you know, with a lot of them have disabilities. She said, we can basically, if you know you're breathing, we can handle it.
Almost
to that level.
Yeah,
not quite because it's a kayak, but
they're.
But I mean, it's amazing what they can do to get people back into it.
That's awesome.
Interviewed, and I'll have to look up which.
Pull up your notes, because I mean, notes. I don't know how you can remember 11 people's names. I mean, I can't remember. You know, somebody will say, "Who did you interview last week?" And I'm like, "Let me look."
Yeah.
It's just my. You can only hold so much in your mind, is what our grandmother used to say. We got to take something out of our brains before we put anything else in there.
Yeah. Let's see.
And you might have to put your glasses on. I see you straining.
Yeah.
You want me to hold the phone for you?
You might need to. I'm trying to. One that I did not get to interview was Chad Walagura. And he was, and I hate that, but people just need to find the links to some of the people that I went to.
I think a nice thing to do would be to maybe... In the show notes, to share even the other podcasts.
Because somebody interviewed him. He is an incredible story. He broke his neck diving into a pool when he was a teenager. I think, maybe he may have been in college. I didn't get to interview him. I just got to kind of ancillarily meet him. And he still has, he duck hunts, he fishes, he gets out. He's got labs and trains and works with. He had two of them with him. Down here, and he is in Wilshire, and just gets around and shot clay pigeons with it. I mean, five stand with us, incredible guy. And so, that's one of the ones that I hate. I missed.
Because it would be fun to have even on the website somewhere, we could suggest different podcasts for people to listen to that.
And then I'm trying to. I think I went
other,
past
your other podcasters that were there. Because Derek has his own podcast.
Derek does have his own podcast. Derek's
Hunt Fish.
Podcast is.
Is it called Hunt Fish? Sorry.
Impact Outdoors.
Impact Outdoors.
He
that's
is
right.
The lead fish and wildlife technician with the Texas Parks and Wildlife.
Okay.
And so he's as high up. I'm a Tech 3. That's as high as I can go. He said, I don't have an advanced degree. I'm trying to find the fella that takes kids fishing. That's what he does. This is riveting.
We'll
this is riveting
maybe
podcast
let's,
right here.
Let's stop and let him find that. How about that? We're back. Yeah. I'll need to get all
I need
of that
to just
stuff
send you
for
this,
you. Yeah.
I just need to send you this thing.
Okay,
me
that's
this
a
guy.
Good idea. Yeah. Yeah, I'll share that with me, and then I'll make you a list. You don't have to go through all of them.
So your response when you were talking about the getting hooked, it reminded me of Timmons' reunion at Possum Kingdom, where one of the other cousins we saw him hook his own bat, and it was like. That brought a new light to the family reunion.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, at least they didn't bring a line.
Yeah, but it was, stuck right here.
Oh, see, that's what I'm saying right there. Uh-uh.
And I was like, okay. Oh, that's
a
family.
I found it.
Yeah. I do. I've tried to get him on my podcast, multiple times. I'm going to have to go and knock on his. My nephew even knows him. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who we talk? Who?
He's a plant prof on Instagram.
PhD.
Oh, he's got a great following, great podcast. He's so fun, social media guy.
He also, I think it was him, posted a
thing. Oh, he hates Bradford Parish.
Yes.
That's how I found out people hated Bradford Parish.
Is he not the one that talks about it being Bradford Parish pruning season?
He's got
and
this
the,
huge.
And the proper way to prune it is to put yourself parallel to the ground.
Yes.
Yeah. Trim a Bradford pear, 1 inch from the ground, horizontal cut.
Yes, that's exactly right. Exactly right. Okay. All right.
Okay.
And we're back.
Now that I had to sort through my notes and see what did. But Chuck Naylor.
Chuck Naylor.
Okay. Let me make sure I get it right. Michael. I wasn't even close.
You were not
I
even
close. I was not even close. Chuck,
well, the problem was you looked at your notes and we talked for
and
a
then
second.
We talked for a second and then
you got distracted.
Away.
Yes, there
Michael
you go.
Michael Shearer. And he.
Yeah, that is not
takes,
Mr. Mike Chuck Naylor.
Not much.
Same.
Takes a lot. He takes. Well, he basically takes people fishing. He has a tank that he'll set up and
what a great
they can
life.
Do, teach them how to fish and stuff like that. And But he works with families. You know, most people are like, take a kid fishing. But he's like, no, I want to take the family fishing. I want to get the family into it.
Yes.
So the family does will go together. Yeah.
And oh, what a great idea.
It's incredible. I mean, the breadth of people that were there is mind-numbing. And what they covered, you know, and it was amazing that, you know, you'd go in and you'd get talking to them about something. And they're like, well, this is really what I want to talk about on the thing.
Yes.
Okay, that's interesting too, but that's whatever. What about that?
Yes.
And so, I'm sitting here, these need to probably be like 30, 45 minutes long. And the only reason that I shut them off at like around an hour is because that was the time slot and they had somebody else to go do.
Yes. Yeah. I will tell you, I mean, that happens so often here. In fact, even today, I'm like, everybody I've had in front of you, I'm like, we need to do a podcast on that next and that.
Yeah. And it's just amazing that not just in environmental conservation or the conservation of the wildlife and that kind of stuff, but in how they've working with other peoples, with charities, and conserving the human spirit, for lack of a better term, just getting people out involved in doing other things, and it's not just the environment that they're taking care of. It's also the community.
That's
you know, it's instilling, you know, it's, they're doing things to instill into the community, and it's to grow certain segments of the community. Yeah.
I think I've told you this before, but like we look at like all of these ecosystems are overlapping. They're all connected, and you impact one, you impact another. And then looking at each of those ecosystems, our economics and our health and our environment through people, planet, and profit, you know, that those things, I think it's so true that which I think is the point for the butterfly effect. It's like, you just don't realize the positive impacts. And I think especially here, because there's not so much stuff to do outside as in other places, you have to be a little more creative here.
You do. And I mean, a lot of that has to do with just the limited public space we have.
Yes. Oh my goodness. Don't even. Know, yes, exactly. We have limited public space. In case you had not known this, in Lubbock, we have very limited public space. We need more green spaces.
We do. I mean, it's, you know, you look at the time frame and where Lubbock grew and when it grew, and it fell outside the niche. All of Lubbock's growth has always fallen outside that niche. You know, you look at other towns and you're like, okay, when did you grow? Well, why do you have all these parks? Oh, well, you were rapidly growing in a place where, in a time when
people
that was
parks.
The thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
And then, you know, we just came out, we pretty much just kind of came out of one just as Lubbock started building again.
Mm-hmm.
And so what do we have? Mm-hmm. We have a bunch of, you know, road track houses that are just, you know, there's not a park.
I am so floored at how few, there's like almost nothing in Southwest Lubbock.
Yeah. It's pretty mind-numbing.
It really is. Unless you're in a really nice neighborhood, there's not a park accessible to you in your neighborhood.
Yeah. I mean, but you know, one of the things I found when I got Cooper, my dog, and I was looking for places to walk a bird dog so that on a Saturday so I didn't have to go to Brownfield, is that there are actually, it's not as bad as I thought it was.
Oh, okay.
I mean,
well, that's good to know.
I'm not saying it's good.
On that side of town.
In town in general.
In general. No, no, there's, I mean, like,
listen, I'm telling you right now, the best place to walk your dog is at a place in an undisclosed location.
Oh.
Because they may have a Lubbock resident here. I don't want anybody else taking the dog spot.
That is hilarious.
But Lubbock does have some good, they have some pretty good dog parks now.
Yes, we do.
So that's helped a little bit. Kudos to
Yes, exactly.
Doing that work.
Yep.
You know, we've spent, but a lot of Lubbock's, our infrastructure budget has gone to building sports fields.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we got an amazing sports
right.
field down there.
Right. Because that's what people generally do.
I mean, you look at it, and that was when the town was growing, when it was building, that was the biggest demand that you had.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I can understand it. I mean, there's, you know, as much grief as I, on the side, give, you know, the members of the city council of doing things for their own betterment.
Yeah.
You know, some of it, they actually listened to what was the demand at the time.
Right. Yep.
And it's just that the underlying demand of and setup of how a city should be planned is different mm-hmm. here than it is.
Oh my gosh, it is really interesting. And my friend Nick Bergfield is like a genius on that, and I wish more people would listen to him. Yeah. Shout out to Nick Bergfield. But that doesn't have anything to do about this. But no. However,
but going back in yes. to getting people outdoors and yes. what they've done. Yes.
And if you haven't gone out to the lake system, yes. like you should go out to the Canyon Lake system. Yeah. If you haven't been out there lately, it is a great place to go. It is a great place. And also the Arboretum, where the Arboretum is, that's another fun place to go.
Lubbock Lake
Landmark, another place to go. So, I mean, there are places. It's just they're not.
You just have to be a little bit more creative.
They're just not right in your face.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's some places they're right in your face. But, I mean, you know, we're also in a semi-arid desert.
We are.
You know,
it's we're also different.
It's yep. you know, the climate is different. You know, and it just yeah. is. And yep. so there's a lot of things that go into how things are done. But this is the thing about I like about the people I talk to is that they recognize a need and they pursue the need.
Yes. You know, I love that. They do something about it. It's
I
like
love
action.
People that do that. And allow me to sit on my fat hind paws.
The most annoying thing to me is like to have like a plan and it never be implemented. I'm like, oh,
yeah,
let's do stuff. Let's do stuff. I want to do stuff.
That annoys me too. That's why I don't plan.
Oh my gosh.
See, some people call it lazy. I call it strategic thinking.
Okay. Well, whatever it is, I'm glad that you were strategically available to go.
But
to
I mean,
this
it was. I mean, those interviews, and sadly, I did them. So
they'll be great.
I have a voice for radio. I mean, what is it? I have
a face
for radio and a voice for silent films. So. You know,
sure you did a good job, or I wouldn't have sent you if I didn't think you would know how to ask the questions.
The people were so interesting, it didn't matter
who
did it.
I know. Podcasting is the best, to me, like, it's like the best thing ever because you just get the best of so many people.
It's incredible.
So
I mean,
awesome.
Interview I did was with Dana Dykema, and she is the one that was from Vancouver, British Columbia.
Oh, okay.
Really, really interesting young lady. And I can call her a young lady because I'm substantially older than her.
So, and she's the one that they tasked to start the new podcast.
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah. It's called, hers is called Ignite Podcast.
Ignite. Mm-hmm.
And really cool lady.
Okay.
And what she
well,
did.
Well, we'll share not just the information for the people that on them, on the on the show notes, but we'll also let people know who those other podcasters that were there and
that was
and how beneficial.
Probably one of the most interesting things about the thing was talking to the other podcasters, the people that had done that, you know, and they would be like, what are you doing? I was like, well, I'm filling in for the professional that does it.
There's not. I'm like, the professionals are behind the camera on this podcast thing.
That's true.
It's not nobody in front of the camera.
That's true. But, I mean, it was just talking to them and hearing their stories.
Yes.
And what they, you know, because invariably, you know, almost all of them got their start because they were interested.
Yeah, that's how I'm like. There's just so many things I'm interested about. I'm surely there's other people out there that want to know these same things.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard somebody say, why'd you start a podcast? Well, I was interested in learning some stuff, and I figured this is the way people would talk to me. You know, so.
That's awesome.
And so you're like, okay, that makes sense. But I mean, just they did a lot of different. I mean, they come from all different walks of life. You know, all different socioeconomic stratas in there.
Yeah.
You know, Dana has got, you know, she's got three teenagers. She's like, you know, her story is she's like, I got married at 19, had my first kid at, I think, 21. Her oldest son is getting ready to go and play baseball at a JUCO in Kansas. You know, she's got a lot of, lot on her plate, just like everybody else. You know, she's got a lot on her plate and stuff, and she has raised, you know, is raising kids and dealing with kids.
That's amazing.
And, you know, I was like, well, you know, how did your kids? And she's like, well, I did all this, jump through all the hoops to get, and starting begin, you know, because she was a what we call an adult onset hunter.
Okay.
So she did. Okay. She was not raised hunting. In any you know really in any stretch of imagination, and just decided one day. You know, she was very focused on where her food came from, and she started off as a basically she was a a go-between between the, the growers and the consumer.
Yes, yes, right. Yeah, trying
and
to
so
deliver,
she would
yeah,
box it up together. And then meet people yeah. and sell it that way.
Yeah.
And she was like, I'm interested in this, but, you know, it ends at protein. Mm-hmm. And she's like, I want to get started. And when you're in Canada, it is not the easy. It's, you don't just walk into Walmart and pick up a hunting license.
No,
which
yeah.
Which I'm not sure Walmart sells hunting license anymore, but now you have right. you can do it on, you can, you know, you can't right. just pick up your phone and.
No, yeah, it's a big deal. Yeah, you don't just carry your gun with you.
Right.
Yeah.
She had to go through all the training, all the licensing to be able to buy mm-hmm. a firearm.
Right.
And then, you know, then she right. went hunting and,
wow.
and got to hunt.
That's really cool.
I mean, it's really cool. But I mean, every person that I interviewed, every person that was there, with the exclusion of myself, was really, really interesting.
I mean, Oh my gosh.
I'm like, hey, I just, you know, I'm just here for, you know, to make everybody else look good. But I mean, they're really interesting people. I mean, and it was a lot of fun. And I can't wait to do it again next year.
I know. Yeah. Next year, I'm going with you.
There you go. As long as it's not during Pheasant Fest.
As long as it's not during Pheasant Fest. Okay. So, well, thanks for making the sacrifice for us. We really appreciate it.
It was a hard one.
And so Dusty and I and my brother Andy, our brother Andy, are also every Friday on KRFE, we're doing an hour and 20-ish minutes of conversation and things that are happening on the Western Dry Side. It's the Dry Side Dispatch. So the Dry Side Dispatch Fridays, KRFE, but we're also live streaming to YouTube, so it'll be coming up on the Sarah channel pretty quickly, and people will be able to see it there as well. And so I'm sure these conversations will come up.
Yeah.
Well, in the future.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm looking forward to everybody get to listen to the people. I mean, they're wickedly interesting people.
That's great.
I mean,
that's great. Really, well, thank you. And thanks for listening, folks. And look, be watching out for the upcoming episodes that we will release that Dusty has so graciously given his time to record.
Well, my pleasure.
See you next time.